Hi, this is Justine Toe, and you're listening to Life and Faith from the Centre for Public Christianity. Well, I'm really delighted to have here today Dale Keane, a professor of politics at St Anselm College in the United States. And he's also the Richard L. Breedy, is that right? Chair in Ethics, Economics and the Common Good, and the author of a wonderful book called Sex and the I World, Rethinking Relationship Beyond an Age of Individualism. So Dale, thank you very much for being here today.
I'm delighted to be here.
Now, in the title of your book, Sex and the I World, we come across a term called the I World, which frequent listeners of this program would hear bandied about every so often, but could you please just give us an insight, you know, from the horse's mouth, sure. Directly, so to speak. What is the I World?
I think it's a world of where individualism reigns. It's a world where each and every individual is seen to be in charge of their own life, their own morality, in terms of defining themselves. And so we don't live anymore in a world where family dominates or neighborhood or city, the things that Aristotle would have talked about. We live in the I World. An Apple computer has made a lot of money marketing that way.
Yeah, so we've really seen, you mentioned Steve Jobs and how you've taken the term iWorld directly from the sorts of individualizing technologies that his company has produced. And it did strike me, have you heard of that Stanford commencement speech that Steve Jobs has given? He gave a speech a couple of years ago, and he says things like, don't let the noise of other people's opinions drown out your inner voice, right? Stay hungry, stay foolish. I mean, this is the I World in a nutshell, is that right?
Absolutely, absolutely. And he really wanted to empower the individual in the world, and he was keen to get the new camera into the iPhone so that in the Arab Spring people could take their pictures and send them out without government interference. He was very much about that.
Yeah. And we also see the influence of the I World in other areas in our culture as well, like Lady Gaga, for example. How does she tell us about what it means to live in the I World?
I mean, her music video, Born This Way, that song, is just an anthem to the I World. I mean, she's basically making an argument that however you perceive you were born, however you seem to be made, you can be what you want to be, you can be whatever it is that you quote, are, and there's nobody that can tell you that it's either right or wrong. It's you.
Yeah. So what is then the best life possible in the I World? Is it just to be you, or tell us more?
I mean, I think the I World, by its very definition, it doesn't decide the best life. I think people by naturally gravitate toward things that could give them the most pleasure. And I would say that sex and money would be the two things that people would gravitate toward. And I would say that there would be a close competition in America if somebody was going to imperil our economic freedom or our sexual freedom. I'm not sure which one we'd give up first, but we wouldn't want to give up either.
There's also the question of self-realization, right? The growing into myself. I have to reach my fullest potential. This is the language of the I World, right? And we hear it from everything from Oprah to the self-help movement, but also psychologists as well. Do you want to comment on that?
Yeah, if there is no overarching explanation for who we are, if it's up to each and every one of us to decide that, I mean, that's the thing that they're celebrating. I think that the difficulty is that in one sense, you never will have the certainty that you have ever achieved who you are. There will always be a question about whether you should have done this or done that or moved in this direction or that direction. So on the one hand, it gives freedom. On the other hand, it kind of breeds a level of insecurity.
Yeah, there's a psychologist, Barry Schwartz. I think he's written a book called The Tyranny of Choice, and he has found some fascinating things that, firstly, we're overwhelmed by choice and we can't actually make a decision. But if we finally do make a decision, he says that we wind up more dissatisfied with that decision because we are constantly plagued by, you know, what if I'd chosen this rather than that? So he says that this is probably why we see a rise of depression and anxiety disorders in the world today, because, you know, we have a lot of responsibility for our lives and we want to choose well.
I think the people that suffer the most would be children. I think adolescents in particular, it's never easy to grow up. Children always struggle with identity in adolescence, and now there's fewer boundaries. And so it doesn't surprise me that we're seeing a rise in depression among youth, suicide, other things, given the fact that we're giving them so little direction about who they are.
Yeah, and I've heard a talk where you were mentioning how Jean-Jacques Rousseau, the French philosopher, sort of counseled that we need to look within ourselves in order to find the answers. What's that like for a generation who, you know, has no guidance and they're told that the answer lies within you?
I think it's a dead end for that generation. Rousseau argues that we should look within, and I think almost anybody in this world has been impacted by Rousseau in that point. Yet shortly after he said it, the philosophers said, no, you're wrong. We can't understand ourselves without a reference point outside of ourselves. So to ask young people to know themselves without a reference point outside themselves is a dead end.
Would you say that the history of the West in some ways has been a discarding of the reference points that, you know, once formally defined us? So, you know, we no longer want to be anchored in some sense. We want to be on the move constantly, not really tied down to any one particular ideology or belief or religion. We want movement, and yet what are we giving up at the same time?
I mean, I think we're giving up security to get freedom. We're giving up definition in order to get opportunity. And I think the question that we have to ask ourselves is, does the I world end in a coherent place that is good for people? And my suspicion is that the I world will not deliver what it promises.
Do you mean because the I world says, you know, I have the right to define what I want to be and so do you, and what if these are conflicting or at odds with each other? Do you mean that it just can't work because you can't have individuals who are just wholly pursuing their own good and not really worried about, you know, the common good?
Well, we have the sense now that we can get by without having to have an overarching moral understanding. But the reality is that you cannot have a society that doesn't have common agreement about morality. Right now, we don't necessarily have the variety of activity we might because people are living in the imagination of the old world. But the more we lose that imagination, the more variety of things we're going to encounter. I think it'll be very difficult to hold society together.
In your book, you talk about the three taboos that govern our behavior today. So firstly, that I'm allowed to do whatever I want so long as I don't hurt anyone. And then secondly, this idea that whatever I do with someone else must be governed by consent. And thirdly, that... could you please refresh my memory?
No, absolutely. Thirdly, it's the idea that if we tell anybody else their life choices are wrong, the fury of hell will come upon us.
Yeah. So you can't judge other people, essentially. I know for myself that I have friends and, you know, we enjoy a robust discussion, but at the same time, we disagree on a number of different things. And we found that over time, it's easier to actually not talk about the things that divide us. But then I'm also wondering, you know, if friendship's about, you know, walking alongside each other and struggling with the things that divide us, and so we just aren't talking about these things. The three taboos, in some ways, does it lead to an impoverishment of public debate and the things that you can talk about because you just know that you'll be driven apart by your differences?
I completely agree with that. I think that we're losing public debate. We're losing civil debate. You can't have a democracy if we can't talk to each other. And political correctness and other things really stifle debate. We're in a situation where if you want to talk about some issues of great importance, but issues that are personally important to people, if you bring up a certain alternative, you're going to be shouted down without even a hearing. That's not democracy.
And what also? What are the impacts of the you know, social media in this? I've done some reading, and I've found that sometimes people will screen out their friends, let's say, who have different political views to them. And so, in some ways, you know, your Facebook wall or your timeline can end up becoming just, you know, you're in a chamber where you only, what is echoed back to you are the political positions that you agree with as well. So it's a real, I mean, this is the I world, right? If you carry it to its logical conclusion, everyone gets to construct their own world and they only get to hear what they want to hear as well. I mean, in some ways, people would say that people of religious faith are just as guilty in some ways of doing this, but this is also an implication of the I world, isn't it?
Oh, sure it is. I mean, ideology and dogmatism can bring all of us to the same conclusion in some fashion in the way that society functions. And social media, I don't believe, is bad in and of itself, but if it allows us to insulate ourselves to such a profound degree that we don't have to interact with other human beings, that we don't have to interact with the ideas of other human beings, and that we don't let other human beings interact with us, you can't have a society if we can't connect with other people.
Yeah. And I wanted to ask you about this. Well, I read this article in the New York Times a couple of weeks ago. It was written for to commemorate Independence Day, and it's called The Downside of Liberty, and it's written by an author called Kurt Anderson. And he talks about his experience of going to the Woodstock Writers' Festival and being asked the question of an audience member that why had the revolution dreamed up in the 60s been won when it came to social and cultural movements? So, for example, women rights, gay rights, now we have a black president, you know, matters of ecology and environmentalism are on the agenda, you know, sex, drugs, rock and roll, where you kind of open the door to all these things. And yet, at the same time, this revolution had failed when it had come to economics. It's like we'd given free rein to the market as well. And then Kurt Anderson says, what happened politically, economically, culturally, this is a quote, and socially since the sea change of the late 60s isn't contradictory or incongruous, it's all of a piece. For hippies and bohemians, as for business people and investors, extreme individualism has been triumphant, selfishness won. Would you care to comment? Would you care to comment on what Anderson has to say?
I think he's right. I think it's one of the ironies of America is that in that respect we reflect Karl Marx. And insofar as Karl Marx was an anarchist and believed that at the end of history there would be no government, and I think the '60s movement was a movement that was not only about sexual freedom and unleashing of a new morality, it was also a statement about throwing down all authority. We're throwing out down the authority of the government for the war in Vietnam. We are discrediting the authority of Wall Street. So I think they were trying to live out the anarchism vision of the philosophy. And I think that's reflected in the way in which we live our lives today in America. So I think they were successful, probably one of the most successful revolutions since the American Revolution.
Yeah. And are you sensing a sense of disquiet and dissatisfaction, perhaps in the way that the I world is operating? Or are we still in its heyday? Are we still enjoying all the fruits of this freedom?
I think we're in its heyday. The reason I say that is you can certainly identify grandparents and parents that are uncertain about this. But the reality is young Americans that I speak to embrace this. This is who they are. This is who they want to be. This is the world they want to live in. And if that doesn't change, that will be the dominant way in which the world works. They are the future.
Yeah, and in your book you also talk about the T world, right? The traditional world where we've come from, that the I world is in some ways reacting against mostly. We have to acknowledge, don't we, that, you know, that world where, you know, God, nation, family, duty, all these things were uppermost, it wasn't all it was cracked up to be, right? So there is some reason for why the I world is incredibly attractive to people today.
Absolutely. A lot of people in the United States want to go backwards. They want to go back to this T world. And I would say, first of all, you couldn't if you wanted to. And second of all, I don't want to go back. I don't want to go back to a world that had slavery, subjection of women. And I don't think it was a world that was relationally healthy for a lot of people, which is why I think people threw it off. But I think we are designed to live in a world in which love reigns. And love is the, you know, currency of relationship. And so I believe we're designed to live in a relational world, but I think we're going to have to go forward, not backward.
And how are we going to do that?
It's not going to be imposed. It's going to be human beings talking to other human beings intentionally decided to live in a relational manner. It's going to be decentralized. It's not going to be, quote, a government initiative. Nobody can make each other love. But the reality is that Christianity has been very effective as a countercultural movement. There's been lots of countercultural movements that have been effective, and when people stand up and say, this is the way I want to live my life, they can make a difference.
Yeah, and you mentioned relational and the importance of relational living, and that, I mean, we can see already that this comes into conflict with the I world, right? Because it's not just about seeking your own good, but about seeking the good of other people.
Absolutely. I mean, at home in America, we don't have a common day off, and one of the problems is that you have to schedule time to even have time together as a family. I mean, that's very difficult to have a family when you have to schedule it in.
So you have to be actually very intentional about making sure that you've got plenty of time to invest in your relationships.
And a lot of people are more concerned about achievement than relationship.
Yeah, it's a wonderful challenge for all of us out there. I just want to say thank you again, Dale, for joining us on this program. And his book is Sex in the I World, Rethinking Relationship Beyond an Age of Individualism. And it's a wonderful read. Thank you, Dale.
Thank you.
So next time on Life and Faith, we're going to be continuing our exploration of the I World, but this time in relation to relationships. So we'll be talking about commitment, non-commitment, and the theme of liquid love, which sounds a little bit naughty, but it's anything but. Tune in next time.